We can only grow less than 1% of all bacteria in the lab. So until about a decade ago, we weren't sure what was out there.
You are listening to Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories, a podcast about surgeon scientists, the things they care about,
and why it matters to you.
We're not superhuman.
You don't have time to specialize in both things at once.
The more I learned about it, the more I recognized that this needed to be brought to the forefront.
When you get a bad outcome, how do you manage your own emotions?
That feeling that you get when the patients say thank you, that's why I do it.
Join the conversation. This is Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories. Hi, I'm David for the University of Minnesota Department of Surgery. Did you know that not all bacteria are bad for you? In fact, there are hundreds of species of bacteria that live within your body right now, helping you digest your food and protect against infection by bacteria that do cause disease. These bacteria, and what they do, is a growing area of scientific research about the body's microbiotic community. Microbiologist Dr. Christopher Staley is among those exploring the link between microbiomes and human health. Dr. Staley is a new faculty member in the University of Minnesota's Department of Surgery. We discussed how the body's microbiome affects overall health and impacts recovery from surgery, new procedures like fecal transplants, and why we need to rethink our relationship with germs.
Well, my background is as a microbiologist, but what I'm really doing in the Department of Surgery is looking at the diversity and the different species of bacteria that are in the human intestinal tract and trying to figure out how the organization of those bacteria is related to different disease outcomes or treatments.
So how did you come to this research, not coming from even a medical background? How did your initial interest in research lead you into medicine, so much so that now you're actually a member of a medical department?
Well, my background was actually more focused in water quality microbiology. So I came to Minnesota as a postdoctoral associate to look at the microbiota in the Mississippi River and figure out how they changed in relation to things like pollution events, like a sewage spill. And what I learned doing that was how to manage the data, how to use different statistical approaches to really come up with definite conclusions. Because when you're looking at the entire diversity of the microbiota, now you're talking about in a river 3,000 or 5,000 different organisms. So it becomes a challenge to figure out how to put those together. But once you figure out how to do that, those skills are really translatable to any environment. So it wasn't really a jump for me to move into different medical studies and figure out how, instead of a sewage spill, a patient intervention, giving antibiotics, or doing a fecal microbiota transplant. It's the same sort of analysis for me.
Tell me more about this thing that you just mentioned, the fecal transplant. I'm not sure that listeners might be aware of exactly what this is or why we might do one. Can you just explain that procedure and kind of how it's become a thing?
Well, one of the major treatment options in medicine has traditionally been antibiotics. And what's happened over the last 100 years or so that we've been doing this is bacteria developing resistances to these antibiotics. So when you get something like a Clostridium difficile infection, the first-line treatment with that is vancomycin, or metronidazole or fidaxomicin. I'm not that kind of doctor. But what happens is you take that antibiotic, you eliminate the pathogen, but you're also going to disrupt a lot of the other species that are in the gut. And those are pretty good bacteria. They actually, because they're there and they're consuming all the nutrients, they're making sure that pathogens like Clostridium difficile can't actually germinate or grow in the intestine. When you treat it with antibiotics, you don't have that beneficial effect of the normal microbiota, so you're really prone to a recurrence of infection. So what fecal microbiota transplant is instead of treating with antibiotics, you treat with good bacteria. So we'll take the stool from a healthy individual that has all of the normal bacteria, and we'll just infuse that into the intestine of the person with the infection. And it shows usually greater than 90% success at resolving specifically Clostridium difficile infection.
Is this a fairly new procedure, or have physicians been doing this type of procedure for a while now?
I'd say it's probably been going on for about a decade, but in the last, I think, 3 to 5 years, it's really become a lot more mainstream now that studies have shown that it's safe. And it used to be more of an emergent kind of therapy where you would have to get the stool of a relative because that's going to be the thing that engrafts in, say, your sister better than just some random guy off the street. What we found is that you can pre-screen donors. So we have a donor program at the University of Minnesota. Where we recruit healthy people and we just bank their stool so that when somebody comes in and they have this infection and they need an FMT, it's in the freezer and the gastroenterologist can go ahead and treat.
This is really fascinating. Something that I'm sure that most listeners probably would not be aware of as a medical procedure that the university works in. The time period that you mentioned that this procedure has been used seems to track the emergence of the idea of the microbiome more generally. And I think that, you know, one thing that listeners might be very familiar with is obviously antibiotics you've mentioned, but then also probiotics, which are a major consumer item, all different kinds constantly being sold, all kinds of advice on the internet about whether you should take them, whether you shouldn't take them, how you should take them. What is the microbiome and why is it such an important idea now?
Well, I'll go back a little to the limitations of microbiology historically, because most people, they think you can grow everything in a lab. And really, we've been limited. We can only grow less than 1% of all bacteria in the lab. So until about a decade ago, we weren't sure what was out there. Sequencing technologies have advanced. I think the Human Microbiome Project started in 2007 or 2008. And what we're doing now is looking at, since we can't grow the bacteria, we look at the genetic material. So we'll isolate total bacterial DNA from a stool sample, for example, sequence it, and now we can get an idea of, okay, there's probably 700 to 1,000 species here. We don't necessarily know who they all are or what they're all doing, but we can start to characterize how shifts in abundance of these things, usually at a broader level. So instead of talking about the specific species like E. coli is the one everybody knows, we'll look at more of the family. So it's in the Enterobacteriaceae. And we'll see how these sort of broad shifts translate into health outcomes and then what we can do specifically to modify the microbiota. So the microbiota are the actual organisms and the microbiome is the DNA. But how we can modify the microbiota to improve health.
And what kinds of conditions do you think are related to an unhealthy microbiotic population and kind of what's the next direction in the research, I guess, that you're doing?
Well, so what we've learned about the human gut bacteria is that there are two really broad divisions. They're called the Bacteroidetes and the Firmicutes, and this is 90% of the bacteria in your gut fall into these two different divisions. We know, broadly speaking, that when you lose abundances of these divisions, when you deplete your Bacteroidetes or your Firmicutes, then bad things start to happen, and this generally corresponds to an increase in a different division called the proteobacteria, and this is where most of the pathogens that people have heard of, E. coli, Salmonella, that's where they reside. As far as specific shifts in the microbiota, it depends on the disease. It's not really generalizable where you can say that if a person's sick, this is what's it's going to, the bacterial community is going to look like A instead of B. It's specific to the disease you're talking about. So for something like a Clostridium difficile infection, where the condition is named after the pathogen, it's really easy. You know what bug you're trying to eliminate. And you know two or three ways that you can go about it. With something like the microbiota or the microbiomes associated with obesity, it is. But we know that at a very different, broader resolution than we would like to at this point. So one of the areas of interest in my lab is to look at which different organizations of bacteria might be pro-obesity, and how many of them are there? Is it a continuum? And then which distributions of bacteria are also related with health? And so we're trying to go at it from two ways. We're trying to find what's wrong, but we're also trying to make what's wrong look like what's right.
So definitely it's a new area. I think it's, I expect definitely that there's still many more questions to be answered. And so I just think it's an exciting new area. I think we've talked about a lot of like sort of extreme parts of this where we talk about, you know, I asked you about diseases, we've talked about obesity, different chronic issues that American society is facing. We've also talked about really extreme things like a fecal transplant in case of a certain imbalance or a disease. But I think another interesting question here is, you know, what do we know about the microbiotic population of our own bodies that is information that can, you know, teach us about how to keep that population healthy or safe and how to safeguard our health using this information?
So there are a lot of host genetics affect a very small percentage of variability in the microbiota. Environmental factors play a pretty big role. Things like diet that you would think are highly influential really only come into play over a longer term. So it's more of a cultural influence of diet on microbiome, whereas if you switch if you don't eat pizza for a week, you're not going to see a huge shift.
You would need to change that pattern for way longer is what you're saying.
Right. Yeah. And even our dietary interventions, what we've seen is just a 4-week extreme dietary intervention going from mostly animal-based to mostly plant-based foods. It's a very minimal change in the microbiota. And that's because your microbiota in general are going to change. You're going to look different in a week than you do today, even if you're completely on a healthy track. As far as what an individual can do to maintain it, I don't think we're at that place yet. You start seeing some of these things hit the market, more probiotic sorts of approaches, some pills. I think there may even be some pills out there now that are supposed to reconstitute parts of a healthy microbiota. These are all things to keep in mind, but I don't think we've reached a point in the science or in the over-the-counter intervention where people can really do a lot to shape their microbiota. It's more of a longer-term sort of lifestyle thing.
And you mentioned that environment is particularly important of the factors that we do know affect it. What kinds of more specific environmental factors do you mean?
Things like your diet have a minimal influence, active versus passive lifestyle, things that are around you. So when you take antibiotics, you're going to deplete your normal microbiota. Well, how are they going to repopulate? So things like household sharing, just living with somebody, can really normalize your microbiota to the person who's living with you. There have been studies that show you'd think there'd be a big difference between a human microbiota and, say, your pet. And there's really not, just because you're in that shared space and you're coming in contact with the same things that harbor the same bacteria.
I think that in general, when we talk about bacteria, you know, after a little over a century of germ theory, I think it is a topic that will make most people a little bit nervous. And I wouldn't be surprised if there are people out there who still have trouble wrapping their head around the idea that, you know, the most of the bacteria in our body is not only benign, but actually probably beneficial in some way. So, you know, changing the thinking from all germs are bad to thinking of us as a constantly existing in more of a symbiotic relationship with the germs that move around us, I hope will be a pleasant revelation to some people who might listen to this. I want to turn to a slightly different question now, because I'm very intrigued by the fact that you get to do this kind of research here. So the University of Minnesota has a long history of, you know, scientific research in medicine. The Department of Surgery in particular has a long history of promoting surgical science, one of the first places to train surgical scientists in the country, you know, an idea that now has become quite popular in, you know, research universities all over the country. I'm really curious about the interdisciplinarity of how it is that you came into this line of work. So you've described that you originally came here to study, you know, bacterial populations in the river, and you found that it translates easily into medicine. How did those connections actually come about? How did, you know, the networking actually happen that put you in contact with the more clinical side of things?
Well, what we've learned in the Department of Surgery and with some of the other clinicians that I've worked with is that we really need to start pursuing research and translational research, so going from bench to bedside in a team science-based way, because it takes 5 or 7 years to get a PhD. It takes probably more than that to be able to work with patients. You don't have time to specialize in both things at once. And if you do, you don't have time to practice both things at once. So you're clinical surgeon who's going to be performing your bowel resection, he doesn't have the time to figure out what the different bacteria are doing. And so that's where I come in. I say, this is the kind of sample I need. Can you give me this? And then I'll tell you how what you're doing physically to the person is affecting this other component of their health. And then we can sort of work together to figure out what the best way to move forward is.
So it seems, again, that because I'm getting that this issue with the microbiotic population is very important in intestinal and bowel surgeries and things like this, especially for patients to recover, again, from some of these more extreme interventions that have to happen sometimes, it seems that surgery still has a lot to teach us about microbiology and just physiology in general. So that has always been, you know, a major outcome of the translational research that the Department of Surgery has done. And so I'm really excited that, you know, we're moving in this great new direction. Is there anything that you think that people ought to know about your research, about the microbiome, and about how your work connects to medicine more broadly?
Well, it really is about changing the way we think about the idea of bacteria and bacterial communities, because we've moved beyond the point where it's a single pathogen or all bacteria are bad. And it's really important now to come to get across the idea that we are still figuring out what a bad microbiome looks like. So you see studies where this or that species is associated with this disease. Well, we really need to make sure that that is a real thing and not just some artifact of one study in one place. And getting that understanding into the society in general, but also into the medical community, where they actually can take a result that I give them and understand what that means to a patient, that's going to be a real challenge moving forward. Because everybody wants to know, they're used to looking at objective tests. This is your morbidity index. This is your concentration of glucose. Well, this is your abundance of Prevotella. And I don't really know what to tell you right now about what that means. But we know how to figure it out if we keep doing the research and we keep really addressing this in a team science way, but also from the perspective of the entire bacterial community.
Dr. Staley, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories is a podcast of the University of Minnesota Department of Surgery and is produced by Amanda Brower. Our audio tech is Brian Carnell. I'm medical historian David Korostyshevsky. Join us next time on Scrubs, Scalpels, and Stories.